Deegan versus Windermere Realty. You want to come forward?
Good morning. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you. Good morning. Beth Terrell on behalf of plaintiffs and the proposed class. May it please the court. This case comes before this court on an interesting premise. We're here appealing an order of a motion to dismiss under 12B6. And as a result, I think what's important is to look at not only what is the standard under a 12B6, but also what sort of legal findings was the court making. This case is important.
You would agree that factual findings have no significance in a 12B6?
I would agree that factual findings have no significance on a 12B6. I would say that the findings that this court made were improper in light of the facts that had been pled in the complaint and the inferences that could be made therefrom. And in particular, it appears that the defendants contend that the first element of the Consumer Protection Act, whether an unfair or deceptive act has been committed, is a question of law. And while that is true, that's only when the facts are undisputed. And so there are no cases that I was able to find where a 12B6 has been granted on a Consumer Protection Act claim in this manner on a 12B6, because there just hasn't been the factual record developed to allow the court to reach that sort of finding.
Can I clarify? There hasn't been no certification of this class action, right?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. No, we're here just on a pleading standard, just like any other case.
And so when you get to the your theory and the complaint at paragraphs 41 and 47, failure to disclose information, what is the causation standard under the Consumer Protection Act for an omission or failure to disclose?
And that's really the crux of the argument, I think, that we need to talk about. And I think that's why this case is not controlled directly by Douglas, which this court issued. Or if it is, it shows why it needs to go back down for a further factual development. Under the Consumer Protection Act, certainly the fourth element is causation, and it is proximate causation. And our Supreme Court has struggled for a number of years over what that exact formulation should be. Does it require reliance, or is it just causation? What happens if it's an omission? Is a material omission sufficient? And so we did finally get an answer to that in the case of Pinog in particular, where the court held that what we're looking at is proximate causation. It's but-for causation, and no requirement of reliance is required unless the underlying facts are truly based on inducement. Something that's really critical here, Your Honor, is that we have two forms of a Consumer Protection Act pled. One is under the deceptive prong or part of the Consumer Protection Act, and the second is that is an unfair act or practice. And again, it became clear after Pinog that is a viable claim that stands separate and apart from deception, and that was completely ignored both by the trial court and in the defendant's briefing on this issue.
How do you prove proximate cause but for causation in a Consumer Protection Act case when it is based upon an omission, whether it's an unfair act or a deceptive act? How do you prove that except to prove something reliance-like?
Well, the proof that is typically offered is based on materiality. So in other words, the issue is, well, there's two things. Number one, there's an omission, and the omission here was the legally required fulsome notice of disclosure of the airport noise. And the damages that we are alleging is the impact on the valuation of that property because our plaintiffs paid more than they would have,
so
sell it for less.
You've got allegations it's material.
That's correct.
Then how do you prove up the causation?
Materiality is based on the objective reasonable person standard. And so what our plaintiffs will testify, if we're allowed to put on evidence and have discovery, is that it was material to them. Had they known about the additional disclosure that should have been provided based on the Island County ordinance, they would have made a different decision and perhaps paid, either not purchased the property or they would have paid less.
Is that an element of your client's prima facie case, that they would have done something different if they had had that disclosure?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, we have to show causation, and we showed that there was a lack of a disclosure and the impact on the property value. And I understand that we have not pled that in the complaint. One of the things that I would ask Your Honors to do is not only to reverse and remand on the basis of the fact that it was not proper to dispose of this case on a 12B6 with no evidence, but also to allow us to amend. There are a variety of errors in the findings that the court made.
Well, is that really necessary when we're dealing with the 12B6 standard? If I can hypothesize that someone not aware of the contents of this might behave differently from someone who was aware of the contents of this, and that difference might have been that they might have refrained to engage in the transaction, is there anything missing from the complaint that would bar me from drawing that hypothesis from the four corners of the complaint?
There, Your Honor, that's a far better answer than what I gave. And under the 12B6 standard, as Your Honors know, hypothetical facts can be used to sustain a claim. And what happened here was the court not only didn't give us the benefit of our own factual pleadings and the inferences therefrom and hypothetical facts, but instead made his own facts that were not based on the complaint, not based on inferences in the complaint, and in fact were based on his own observations of the situation, which, by the way, what's really critical is the time frame here, right? When our clients were making these purchases and the nature of the disclosures that were made. Two quick things in addition. What's really a problem with this failure to disclose is not only was it legislative required, but they didn't provide it prior to the closing. Okay, so there was no time to do the inquiry that defendants claim we were obligated to do, and there was no map provided so people could even identify it. Thank you.
Your Honor, Chris Brain representing the defendants. I want to correct one thing. They were provided Form 22W at the same time they executed the purchase and sale agreement. So they were on notice on day one that there was significant noise.
And you're telling us that because that would bar me from hypothesizing that if they'd been instead provided or in addition to provided the notice that was required by 944050, they might have decided, you know, I don't want to go knock on the neighbor's doors. I'm just not going to close this deal.
Your Honor, I think the reason that this case is properly decided, and by the way, there...
Am I barred from hypothesizing that?
No.
That's my question. So if I can hypothesize that, then the trial court's ruling was wrong, right?
I don't agree, Your Honor.
I mean, going and knocking on the neighbor's doors has nothing to do with it.
No.
My hypothetical purchaser doesn't want to walk down the street. He wants to not engage in the deal if he's been told these more egregious things that are set forth in 050.
Well, Your Honor, I think that depends upon whether you're going to follow Visser or not, because what Visser says is if you
Visser was after a bench trial, right?
Your Honor, it shouldn't make any difference. If the law of the state is that once you have a disclosure, you have a duty to investigate.
No, you don't. You have the disclosure and you haven't closed yet. You can opt not to close.
That's right.
Okay. That's what my hypothetical purchaser would do. He would opt not to close if he'd been given the warnings in 050.
Your Honor.
So Douglas and Visser has nothing to do with it because there's no deal that ever closes.
Your Honor, the duty in this.
How can I not hypothesize that he wouldn't have closed?
Your Honor, I think the point is that he had the notice. And if you have the notice and you have the duty, and I would also go to...
No. If you have the notice, then you have an option. My hypothetical purchaser takes his option. I'm not going to buy. He doesn't have any duty once he's not going to buy. And we've agreed that I can hypothesize that he wouldn't buy.
But let's look at the facts. The facts are, I didn't know I had a problem.
The facts don't matter. Anything that I can hypothesize that's consistent with the complaint. This is a 12B6. This isn't summary judgment, and there was no bench trial like this.
Okay. I don't agree.
You don't agree that that's the standard?
I don't.
Or you don't agree that I can't hypothesize from what's in the complaint? What don't you agree with?
I think you have to reasonably look at what's pled, and you have to make a determination whether or not it is judicially deficient. And here, they were on notice. And if you take the cases that say, and we're dealing with real property here, you're on notice and you have a duty to investigate. Form 17 itself, and I can quote what it says. Form 17.
So you're taking the position that they had a duty to close the transaction.
No, they had a duty to investigate.
Well, no, they don't. Investigation has nothing to do with it if there's not going to be a sale.
Oh.
If there's not going to be a sale, there's nothing to investigate. I'm not going to buy.
Let me quote Form 17.
Well, don't quote Form 17. Tell me why Form 17 matters if there's no sale.
The issue
your entire theory relies on the premise that they had a duty to close.
No, it doesn't. It relies upon the fact that they had a duty to investigate if they were going to proceed to closing.
And my hypothetical purchaser was not going to proceed to closing if he found out what was an 050.
Form 17 says, buyer has a duty to pay diligent attention to any material defects that are known to buyer by utilizing diligent attention and observation. Now, if they're going to ignore that duty and not close, fine, they don't have to close. I agree with you. But the point is, if they're going to go forward and close, they can't ignore the duty that is put on them to investigate. And that's where the hypothetical is.
Yeah, but these purchasers wouldn't have closed if they knew it was an 050.
You don't know that.
Yes, I do, because I hypothesized it from what was in the complaint.
Because
you brought a 12B6 motion. You didn't bring a CR 56 motion, and you didn't go to a trial. You brought a motion at a time when the standard is that the decision maker can hypothesize any state of facts that are consistent with what's in the complaint. And I've hypothesized one that doesn't support your legal theory.
I think, again, Your Honor, I'm going to go back to it. If you have a duty to investigate, you don't have that option, and that's where we...
I have to close. So it does come down. We have now arrived at it. There is a duty to close.
No, there is not a duty to close. There's a duty to investigate before you make the decision as to whether you close. Had they investigated, which is what the duty they had, then they would have found out. And this was not rocket science.
So, again, you're barring me from hypothesizing that if they knew it was an 050, they would not have closed. Everything you're saying depends on telling me that I can't hypothesize that. Because if I can, then this decision was wrong.
They had a duty to investigate. One of the things that this notice told them was call the county before you purchase and find out about the ordinance.
So aren't you shifting the burden from what the Island County Ordinance says? Island County Ordinance says you have to tell prospective purchasers of this type of property this information. And you're saying it's enough if we tell them some information that should put them on inquiry notice that will cause them to call the county before deciding whether to purchase.
Yes.
Isn't that reversing the obligation from what the Island County Commissioners decided it should be?
Your Honor, I think that's what Visser says the duty is.
Well, Visser's a little different. Visser, they had in hand a report that actually told them there was rot, and they didn't do anything more after their expert had told them there was rot. Here, we don't have any factual investigation in Judge Dwyer's hypothetical. We're hypothesizing people that, given a certain level of information, don't want to take the trouble to educate themselves further. They want to walk away.
It says significant notice.
Significant notice, pay attention.
A noise.
Okay, if you get the notice that tells you this much, maybe you should investigate further. But if you get the notice it's this level of noise, you don't care about what investigations might tell you. You just don't want to be bothered with the whole situation. And you're saying the purchaser who just would walk away with giving the full notice doesn't get considered in evaluating whether the plaintiffs have adequately pled a cause of action.
Your Honor, I think that when you get notice that there's significant noise, let me quote another provision that I think is remarkably similar. This is Form 17 edition. And this has to do with smell. Noise, smell.
Why would we look to Form 17 when we have a local jurisdiction's set of rules?
Because Form 17 is what the real estate and what the state looks at is overriding what your duties of disclosure are. And what
you suggest that overrides a higher burden?
No, I didn't say it overrides, but I think it gives you direction. And what I'm saying here is, let's listen to this. This notice is to inform you that the real property you are considering for purchase may be in close proximity to a farm. The operation of the involves the usual and customary practices which are protected under RCW 748, the Washington Right to Farm Act. That is the type of notice that is given where you have a subjective issue, such as smell. And here we're talking about a subjective issue. How loud is loud? Okay.
We have something that can be scientifically measured in decibels. We have something that is the subject of studies demonstrating health hazards.
Okay. And
so
at the time,
that's objective information.
And at time of 1992, when the ordinance was passed, the growler did not exist. And their complaint is based upon the growler noise, not the prowler noise, because they didn't know they had a problem until the growler started flying well after they purchased.
The county legislative authority made a determination as to what the minimum warning should be. Can I hypothesize that that should be treated by us as the minimum warning that should obtain?
Well, okay, there's another case, and that is the Shepherd versus Holmes case, and that has to talk about public records. And when you have a public record, you have a duty to go ahead and look at that public record. And that really goes to the issue.
Well, but this assigned the duty, and it didn't assign it to the purchaser. It assigned it to the seller.
Well, that
would seem to a direct finding by the county legislative authority would seem to trump any case that's construing something else.
But not as far as the statute of limitations issue. And that's the second issue that we have here, Your Honor, is the fact that the statute of limitations bars Mr. Deegan from pursuing his action.
Except when you look at the pleadings, the allegations are 2005, they began the transition. That doesn't identify when a reasonable person would have known. Isn't that a fact question that remains for trial?
How would their agents know? They were not clairvoyant either.
Your time's expired. Thank you, Mr. Rain.
Island County decided that in 1992, those engaged in selling real property needed to give a very specific and detailed disclosure to potential buyers.
And he also said that it doesn't create an independent cause of action. So what effect do we give it since at the time that they passed this, they did not want to have it be at least the sole basis for a cause of action?
That's correct. We're not suing under the Island County Ordinance itself, but it is evidence of an unfair and deceptive act, the failure to give that. Similar that, in some of the cases, a TILA violation, while it doesn't give rise directly to a Consumer Protection Act claim, courts have found that that's evidence of a deceptive act. So it's just something to be taken into consideration. The fact that it did not provide for a private right of action does not bar a Consumer Protection Act claim.
What's
based on
those facts.
What's the
difference between an unfair act and a deceptive act? You talked about this earlier.
Yeah. So there are two sort of distinct and evolving tests.
Let me ask more specifically. Sure. It seems to me that something can be unlawful but not deceptive. Can something be unlawful but yet fair? Or if it's unlawful, is it necessarily unfair?
embedded within the definition of unfair that the FTC has used and that our Supreme Court and some of the appellate courts have referred to is the notion that if the conduct has been determined to be unlawful really by any agency or statute, that that is good evidence that it is also unfair.
Is this a deception case at all?
I think it's arguably both, and that's one reason why we needed to develop the facts and why we pled them separately. The question is whether giving a narrow, much more specific disclosure that only talks about construction and is in the building code, giving that to buyers who are entitled to a very fulsome noise reduction disclosure that gave a lot of detail about the airports and the military, whether just choosing to give that disclosure is in and of itself misleading. And there's plenty of cases under the FTC Act and otherwise that say giving a partial disclosure, an incomplete disclosure, well, that in and of itself is deceptive conduct. Why? Well, because the plaintiffs were perhaps relying on that was it, that's all they needed to know, was that if they bought in this zone, which of course they didn't know because the map wasn't ever attached, they needed to maybe retrofit if they were going to remodel it. I mean, it just didn't tell them the kind of information that they wanted to know before they purchased these homes. This is not a Form 17 case. This is a Consumer Protection Act case. The elements are different. And I believe that what this court meant in Douglas, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong, had to do with proximate cause and not with whether or not it was an unfair or deceptive act as a matter of law. Thank you.